Welcome, everyone, to the AI in Business podcast. I'm Matthew DeMello, senior editor here at Emerge Technology Research. Today's guest is Bakalpa Nupain, head of artificial intelligence, Gen AI, and natural language processing at Takeda. Bakalpa returns to the program to talk about the difference between a legacy enterprise culture and a data-based enterprise culture, explaining along the way how legacy leaders in sectors as diverse as healthcare, financial services, manufacturing, and beyond can make the transition in today's AI-driven global economy. Later, we pull apart challenges for large enterprises as more open source AI tools become available to individuals, eroding the traditional and structural advantages legacy firms have long held in the marketplace. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Bakalpa, thanks so much for joining us again on the podcast.
Hey, Matt. Glad to be here back again. Thanks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great pleasure having you again. Just pulling from where we just about left off in the last episode, it seems like there are two big trends happening in life sciences. It's legacy firms are sitting on data, but all the moats are generally shrinking when it comes to data. I could probably say harsher things if we're familiar with the Google memo, but let's put that general trend out there. And what are some of the capabilities in that case that organizations will be able to build regardless of their size in the healthcare space?
Awesome. I think you are right when you said that there is no moat, right? And Google is right, and we all know this. I did read an article from this company, I believe it was Andreessen, and they did a really cool research on the topic. It says something along the line of 80% of the top 50 Gen AI products today didn't exist a year ago, and only 5 out of 50 are associated with the big tech companies, right? And to give you a count, there are at least 5,000 plus apps that leverage LLMs and Gen AI as their backend engine that happened within the past 10, 11 months, right? Since the ChatGPT was announced, I would say. So in other words, every company is trying to create their own value, right? But they are all using the training models, data from Hugging Face, or one of these large providers from Google, from Facebook, from Microsoft, from OpenAI. But none of them haven't really captured that space, right? Now, if you look at the life sciences companies in general, what's going to be interesting is there are a series of models that are out there for us to go and implement, right, experiment with in the clinical space and in biomedical space, BERT models. But we do still struggle with achieving that kind of relevancy and accuracy with the results, just because a part of our data, healthcare, life sciences data, hasn't been shared with any of these models yet. And I think the only way we could win this, we could have better results, is bringing those models in-house, doing some kind of fine-tuning and experimentation, and really leverage that differentiation. So it's hard. I mean, predicting who's going to be the moat, who's going to win. The key thing to understand here is which part of these companies, which part of the stack are truly going to be differentiated and defensible in the market. And so far, we do not have that clarity, right? We'll probably see in the next few months or perhaps years, I guess.
Right. So at this point, the moats are just not reliable. There's that, just to put a finer point on it for folks. I suspect most listeners probably are familiar with this Google memo we keep bringing up, but it's called "We Have No Moat and Neither Does OpenAI." And basically the gist is a lot of what we're talking about, that we're going in this direction where there's no institutional necessarily advantage with Gen AI and the data involved. And whether we're talking about the somewhat narrower field of Gen AI or these enterprise capabilities more broadly, I think a lot of folks at the larger megatech firms are realizing the structural advantages they've enjoyed for a long time are going to start to disappear as we get further into these Web3 technologies. So I'm wondering, how do you think small firms should go about this transition? How should they go into the strategies? How should they prepare?
Yeah, again, going back to my previous point, we are too early to say this. Tech. It's like that emergence of internet and iPhones, right? Back in those days, I was too young, but if I was an interviewer or on a podcast back in those days, I would be having a hard time to answer the questions like this, right? Someone asking, sure, which internet provider would have led the market, or way that iPhone was going to take the 100% of the market capture. Today, we see many internet companies, right? We have Comcast, we have AOL, we have Spectrum, Google, and all those companies. And we have Android phones out in the market. And there's BlackBerry, there's a lot of Asian phones, you know, Indian phones that are coming out of the market. Market is big enough, right? And it's not clear who's going to be the winner in this. So I am less concerned about who is going to be the moat in this space and whether there's going to be a distributed aspect of the markets here. But we will see on that regard. In terms of how smaller companies or smaller to mid-sized organization can set up for success in LLMs and Gen AI is really looking around the differentiated aspect of the data and the tools and the platforms they use, right? Now, today, we do not have that because many companies have the same model under the hood, right? A lot of the 5,000 plus apps that are out there in the market, they are either using one of these models from Microsoft, from Google, from Facebook, from Amazon, you know, Hugging Face, Transformers, and all of that, right? So what is it that makes them unique? So in the absence of this strong technical differentiation, right, any of these B2B or B2C apps, they will have to drive this long-term customer value through some kind of differentiation, right? It could be network effects. It could be holding onto their unique data. It could be embedding this model as a part of the complex workflows, which is already scaffolded as a part of different software tools that they provide to the enterprise customers. So it's really hard, right, in that space. So I would say this is evolving field, and the barrier to entry in terms of apps and software because of this, you know, large scale model development is less. So anyone can come in, anyone can get out just because their data is not robust enough or unique enough. It's yet to see, right? For any small companies, I guess my experience sharing will come around the fact, focus on your data, focus on what you are good at, focus on the part of their entire workflow. That's going to be the unique differentiator as much as I can tell today.
Yeah. Okay. So basically the future is unwritten as much in, you know, we've had this episode, small E episode, not a podcast episode, but we've had this episode before in the AI conversation. Everybody loves to pull out that video of Jeff Hinton saying, stop training radiologists now. And we just know that's not true and not practical, you know, like that's the same fog of war, right? Like we know in the extreme long term that, you know, at the foundations of this technology that, you know, the conclusions that led to that memo, you know, nobody has a moat. But all at the same time, from what you're saying, in the short term, you still do have advantages and you still need to leverage them. And let's maybe wait a little bit while longer on the death of all moats. It will be bad. I wouldn't put my money on moats, but no, it might not be as drastic as we've seen. And it might, and you know, all this attitude of there will be no moats also doesn't mean these moats are going to disappear overnight. And it'll be within everybody's strategic interest to, you know, leverage what they have for the time being while they have it. Now, I guess that gets into how to adopt this technology and then scale, because that's obviously going to be a challenge. How do you build scaling considerations into the adoption process, especially when you're not sure how fast or quickly the project itself is going to scale?
Right. And I get asked these questions all the time as well, right? In my current company and the other places that I present to, I would always start out by, you know, simply telling an experimentation mode, right? You keep hearing this, a culture of experimentation. And in my current company, we have enabled this service, a pathway called experimentation as a service. So which basically allows our stakeholders, business units, and business functions to come and use one of these greatest and latest technology in a safe, regulated environment. We call this AI lab, for example, right? Or a sandbox. When it comes to scaling, though, I don't think many companies out there have enabled these use cases for Gen AI and, you know, our, you know, LLMs today and scaled successfully, just because we're all in that watch and play mode, right? Not being able to have that confidence in the entire program of Gen AI and LLMs yet. But you are also right when you mentioned we don't want to be stopping because we do not have clarity on who the clear winner is going to be, right? Perhaps there will be a lot of them. So maintaining that balance of experimentation and innovation while also not trying to be absolute in the name of waiting for a mature player in the area is something that we are looking at, right? So I would say start out by experimentation. right? And then you graduate that experimentation to some kind of product and some kind of scaling and production environment, things like that. But when it comes to scaling itself, right? I mean, this is a different kind of conversation, just because I have heard many companies and startups started to talk about the cost of AI, right? Or data science. I think there are not that many departments out there that they are looking AI and data science as a net revenue generator, right? So I would, so it really depends on the company size and the company verticals. But I would say AI and data science is a net cost for many corporations even today. So you are looking at what does it take to enable that AI and data science, right? Now, that means infrastructure cost itself. The platform readiness in itself is something, a big investment that you'll have to think about. With large language models, you know, I know people want accurate results. They want fine-tuned results best for the proprietary data. What does that mean? That means you have a higher inference cost, you have a higher training cost, you have higher, you know, data center cost, you have the hosting cost, right? That alone itself is something that you have to be looking at, right, when it comes to scaling. So you don't want to do a great project in AI and data science and just break the flow out there and not being able to scale just because there's a limitation surrounded by the infrastructure itself. And then you have the issues around guardrails, right? Risk assessment and privacy, a whole host of things that we talk about in AI and data ethics, right? That's really important to do. So I would say, you know, there's different components of scaling, right? So the one that I mentioned is around experimentation. The other I just talked about is the cost of AI. And the last cost in terms of this scaling, I would also speak around the patterns itself. So as data science and AI start to emerge, what you're really looking at is there is the cost of these different patterns that you use, right? For data science, you might probably use tons of libraries and frameworks, right? In LLMs and Gen AI, you know, you might have seen lots of articles talking about, hey, I'm not going to use fine-tuned models, but I'm going to use RAG patterns, retrieval augmented generation, right? Which basically relies on the context of the data to give you the results that are better than the out-of-the-box models, but they are not as good as fine-tuned models. But there's the business decisions, right? So when it comes to scale, there's a much lower cost, right, for the business to invest into, but still get something out of the AI system. These are the, you know, ranges of scaling and behaviors, attributes that we'll probably have to pay attention to. Yeah. And in GPU, right, I read somewhere that for each dollar of GPUs, there's also $1 needs to be spent on energy these days. Now we are talking about energy and carbon change and climate change and all of that. That's 100 billion of data center expenditure entering the system. Now think about this. Where does this cost go to? This cost go to one of these enterprise users. So it's not just enabling it. It's not just maintaining it, but also the whole background cost that comes with it in terms of scaling. Yeah, those are a few that I wanted to outline.
Absolutely. And just to your point on energy, I know there was a big story very recently about just how much water, you know, OpenAI uses in terms of, you know, just keeping their servers cool. And it's actually leading to further water scarcity problems in the Bay Area, which I know they absolutely don't need. But I'll let everybody look up that article before I misquote it and put out some misinformation out there, although that might be par for the course for OpenAI. And that's my one joke about ChatGPT. But just getting back to here, my mind is blown by RAG patterns, and I could probably just do a whole episode on that, and I'll probably call back to that moment in your last answer when we do the outro for the show. But just to try to really cover all the bases that we wanted to today, I'm wondering how demand management really fits into this, where it's being prioritized, and how it's driving that scaling, or at least how business leaders should think of it. That was the only thing maybe in that last list that I didn't hear was really driving the conversation. And I know that that's usually the major factor in how scaling is operating, even with AI capabilities where we don't have a fog of war. They've been around for a while, and you know, things like machine learning.
No, yeah, that's a great question, Matt. I think I do remember the statistics that you shared about the water, you know, consumption. And I think ChatGPT consumed 1.7 billion gallons of water, which is about 25,000 Olympic-sized fields, right? That is really cool. You know, just sharing.
I was going off the top of my head, but I didn't want to just say an astronomical. I knew it was in the billions, but you know, sometimes when you're going off the top of your head, it just sounds like you're making it up. But I might have underestimated it.
I forgot the source, but that's about it. At the ballpark.
Yeah.
So yeah, going back to your demand management and prioritization question, I think that's something all companies are going through today. In my company, we have had a collection of use cases just in AI and data science, I would say around 100, right? Give or take across the organization. And I'm sure many organizations are dealing with the flood of demands coming in. So for the data readiness, for the platform readiness, AI and data science readiness, right? We're looking forward to establish that AI, machine learning, data science, architecture principles. At the same time, we're also looking at some of the determining criteria. So if I were to summarize things that I know today, right, I would try to look at the demand management from the business impact and the ease of execution perspectives, right? If you were to place it on a graph, I would say business impact will be your x-axis, whereas ease of execution will be your y-axis. And then you'll probably plot your different use cases, you know, on that axis. But now let's double click on what are the business impact levers are going to look like. And this is where the product management, classic product management principle comes in, that you would be looking at the alignment with the key strategic areas of your organization. You do not want to deviate from these corporate goals and visions just because the new tools and technologies have just emerged the market, right? So that's very important. The size of the customer, right? Depending whether your customers are internal or external, then you look at what is the value realized, right? It could be cost savings, increased productivity, efficiency, new product in the market. And of course, the financial impact, right? So we're always looking at ROI in terms of our, you know, data science work. Also make sure that you look at things like future fit and relevancy. And I'll always try to talk to my executives and leadership around this aspect a bit too much. This is a rapidly evolving field. What you do today, right, you know, you don't want to throw in the next 6 months or a year from today. So we want to be designing our patterns. So we want to keep it so modular so we can always have a replacement mechanism so that we don't have to scrap everything that we built, right? So right, these are the business aspects of how I'm going to look at the use case or the AI investment. But if you look at the technical execution, which other than the scaling cost, which I mentioned earlier, the cost of doing AI, make sure that When you evaluate a use case and an idea, is it feasible within the scope of your organization, your technical assets? That means your data, that means your infrastructure, and that is your talents. And then you go about having the conversation on the capacity and sizing. What is the level of effort that you need to be ready for the data science work, right? I think this summarization, this factoring of business impact and technical execution will probably give you some kind of indication to make a selective AI investment or selective data science investment. And I'd always recommend starting with this high-level approach. And you probably have to fine-tune this, you know, based on your corporate needs and data size as well.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of this answer, we were talking, you know, before we turned the recorders on and even just preparing for these last two episodes. I know you're very passionate about the success of a data-based enterprise culture in terms of successfully hiring these teams and making them feel right at home from the start. I know this is where a lot of your last answer is coming from, just in terms of like how you want to talk to executives to get that buy-in and what you want to emphasize. But I'm wondering if we can even take things to a higher level here. What do you find are the best ways to get started in laying the groundwork for a data-based company culture where you even set about hiring a data science team?
Yeah, this is something I'm highly passionate about. I'm also building a team of data scientists and AI engineers in the US and internationally. So I'm looking at this topic as an opportunity to learn about data science hiring space as a whole, right? As I do my exercise, I've realized that you might want to differentiate between the definitions of the data scientist in itself. It's a broad field, just about software engineering and data science and AI is as big. You are probably looking at dealing with the core data scientists in my category. They are advanced PhDs. They are folks with advanced knowledge and expertise. And there's also a set of data scientists we call citizen data scientists, right? They sit in the business. They sit within, they have their own unique skills and contributions, have a strong business domain experience as well. So before you go out there and want to build the data science functions, make sure that you really understand the persona that you are dealing with, right? That's my biggest
point. Right.
Next part of this is truly know who you hire and retain, right? Hiring in today's market, it's probably easier than, you know, previous months. We have a lot of candidates out there just because of the macroeconomic conditions, but I'll be focusing more on retaining these talents, right? I mean, they come in and we want to make sure they're intellectually stimulated, culturally adapted, they're included as a part of the whole data science practice. And when you hire, you do not want to be confusing a rockstar PhD or someone who has done advanced open source or who are sharp at algorithms and mathematical components, problem solving wise, with someone who has data science, but strictly contained within the tools and platform space, right? Data IQ, Data Robot, and all of that, right? So you do not want to kind of mix and confuse them, because it will create some kind of disconnect in the team and the culture itself. So make sure that there's a strong differentiation on that. The second component I would say is, when you have hired them, utilize them, right? I've said in so many conversations where I've realized that it's a common occurrence in organizations to hire a bunch of data scientist talent, but then they quickly go into these frustration cycles when their skill set is not as utilized, right? Or accounted in the decisioning making process. And if you look at the mental model of these technical folks, right, the data scientists and AI engineers, they would like to be mentored by folks who are technical. They would like to be have someone who is out there they can intellectually debate their models with. As much as they love this whole organizational process about, they also have a strong urgency to action. So make sure that we enable the data scientists that we hire as a part of the whole process, but also probe them to some kind of action, right? Pair them with our data scientist, a technical mindset who can help them navigate this whole process itself, which is something that we are very good at enabling at my current company, right? We do provide this kind of environment for data scientists to come and provide the feedback in the whole decisioning factor as well, but making sure that they have some action items to work on, right? They get excited by the models. They get excited at shipping things in production. They get excited by the dashboard and different graphs and accuracy metrics, right? So let's tap into that as soon as possible. And the third thing that I would definitely like to focus on is the concept of data science scientist experience, just like developer experience back in those days. A lot of the companies started putting effort in infrastructures and platforms and APIs that will help enhance the developer's experience overall. But you wouldn't find many companies investing on data scientist experience. So as an organization, what you can do today is make sure that your platforms and infrastructures, your libraries, frameworks, they're all ready for a new data scientist to come and join your company, and they get invested and they get utilized right away. So I call this data scientist experience just like developer experience. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. No, it absolutely does. And I think even the comparison to, like a VC playground makes a lot of sense. If only because, especially the two disciplines are just so closely entwined by this point of AI development. Absolutely.
Right. And you did bring up the VC, right? So data science is a lot like venture capital. So you make lots and lots of bets, expecting most of them to fail, but you are betting that one, and that particular one, which is going to provide you a big payoff, which brings the point home: allow data scientists an environment to experiment with, right? They are so inclined to do things right away, and provide them the data, access to this sandbox environment and AI lab environment where they can enter the process as early as possible.
Right. And the same goes for VCs. And it's in that experimental nature. But to tie this into the beginning of our episode, just where we were talking about, shrinking moats, kind of this new ecosystem coming around where you'll have big fish and small fish, and it may make more sense for them to partner together in order for their capabilities to have the maximum impact on patient experience, et cetera. I know we're seeing this kind of in the macrocosm with generative AI in general, OpenAI partnering with Microsoft, big fish getting together with small fish. Even when, say, those small fish have the data science talent in place. How should they think about partnering with legacy firms? How should they know their own limitations with that data science team, their own organizational limitations in their capacities to access enough data to fuel these capabilities?
Yeah, that's a great question. And maybe I will take a bit a differing view on this topic in terms of the partnership. Don't get me wrong, I'm all about collaboration and partnership, right? But there's also an opportunities that lie within the organizations itself when it comes to data. You know, in our previous version of our podcast that you know we did last week, we discussed about one of the biggest challenges the industry is facing today is having this siloed and disconnected data, right? So if you look at any mid to large organizations, whether that's pharmaceuticals, life sciences, or finance, or any companies, you see tons of unstructured data lying around today. Your interaction data, your phone data, your hundreds of PowerPoints, your Jira issues, your SharePoint docs, your Confluence articles, a lot of free text form data. At the same point, we're also generating those data, you know, at every second. So the bigger amount of work is to be done internally within the organization to take all of those data into one place and make sure that we enable pathways to capture the data, right? So once you get a hold of that, then you can go out to one of these legacy firms like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, or any other companies that are willing to augment that data with the data that they have with or that are already as a part of their models. And then you can definitely get a big win out of that. But there's also a differing view that other companies take. Sometimes they just wanted to go on a partnership mode with large tech just because it accelerated the innovation. They already come up with preloaded models. They already come up with a data set they can use out of the box, you know, on the fly. That is also a very good approach. But I do see a humongous opportunity to navigate around the data space within your own organization first prior to reaching out externally, because that will probably allow you some kind of mental space to process what's going to happen with your own company and with the corporate data that you own, right? That me coming from life sciences and pharmaceuticals, we deal with a lot of PII data, a lot of healthcare data.
Right.
And I want to make sure that our data science investment and vision really taps into that patient trust, right? Reputation, you know, that we have in the market. So I do not want to do things today for doing sake today, right? In the catch of the competitions or hype, but also setting things for the future, right?
Right.
That's my goal.
Just like you were saying, in future fit, you know, you got to be thinking 6 months ahead. You got to be thinking like, you know, if this is not going to fly, do we have a backup? Do we have another system? And the same goes for how to think of these partnerships. Absolutely. Bakalpa, really, really fascinating stuff. I think this is a real compliment, especially to the, you know, more general issues that we talked about in the first episode. Also really applicable. I really hope, you know, we had a lot of our folks across industries were tuning in, not just from healthcare, which tends to be the case, I know, because there's lessons to be learned from every industry. And we love having folks like you on the show to help teach us those lessons. So, Bakalpa, thanks so much for joining us again on the program.
Thanks, Matt.
Wrapping up today's episode, I think a great place to start if you want to learn more is to check out the first episode that we aired with Bakalpa Newpain on this podcast. That's the AI in Business podcast from Emerge. You can check out that episode. It is dated December 26th, 2023, the day after Christmas. As I was telling Bakalpa, I'm something of a subject matter expert in this regard for any of you that have decided to Google me outside of the Emerge context, but I always find the days after Christmas are the best times for podcast listening, or at least reading a good book. Either way, we're coming up on spring as of the time of this recording, so I guess there's no bad time to check out old podcasts. That episode is titled Building Trust in Data Science and Life Sciences with Bakalpa Newpain of Takeda. And again, it's dated December 26th, 2023. On behalf of Daniel Fajella, our CEO and head of research, as well as the rest of the team here at Emerge Technology Research, thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time on the AI in Business podcast.